And so I'm doing this contract work and it would come and go. And so, yeah, 1 month I made like $12,000 or $15,000, huge amount of money. And then the next month I had no work. And so I was like, oh, I got to learn to save. And then, oh, taxes come up, right? Estimate, I'm 1099 now. You get it. So like all that stuff I had to learn right around that 2001, 2002 timeframe.
I'm here with Rob Walling, and I have to admit, over the last month or so, I've binged probably between 100 and 150 episodes of Startup for the Rest of Us. I just took a family vacation down to California. I'm in northern Utah, and I had an 11-hour drive each way, so that I was able to knock out a good amount. So I'm feeling really, really prepared for this conversation.
That's great, man. Well, my condolences, and also thank you. I really appreciate you consuming that much audio.
Yeah, absolutely. I do consume a lot of podcasts, but it's definitely become one of my favorite this year. So for those of my audience who don't know, you are the founder of Drip, Tiny Seed, MicroConf. Obviously, you're the host of the podcast Startups for the Rest of Us. I can't believe how many episodes you've recorded. It's like 670 something by now. You are a programmer. We're a programmer now. Obviously, you do more entrepreneurial stuff. What did I miss?
Author. I've written 4 books on entrepreneurship and building startups. The first one was Start Small, Stay Small, which is really, it was almost like marketing for developers, you know, or how to like launch a little nice lifestyle business. Honestly, it was kind of like indie hackers before that was a term, right? Because I had like 8 or 9, it was actually about 10 projects that were each doing $1,000 or more per month between 1 and 5K. So that's what I was, you know, and there's folks doing that today, but like that, this was in 2009, right? So that's what that book was based on. And then I've written a few since then. The most recent one's called The SaaS Playbook. I think I have a copy here. And that's more for like, if you want to build a 7 or 8 figure, you know, SaaS company without venture capital. So maybe you raise a little money, maybe a bootstrap. But I found that writing books is painful, but it's a way to like distill hundreds of hours of like content and thought into like the most actionable 200 pages that I can do.
Yeah. I'm so excited that this one's a hardback. I have a thing where like I kind of only buy books in hardback form. I don't know. I just don't like paperback. Occasionally I'll listen to the audio, but I was really excited to see that you did this one in hardback. Definitely be picking that one up. I just listened to Start Small, Stay Small. Fantastic book. One of the things that's really interesting to me is obviously you're very focused on B2B SaaS, and Boot.dev, which is, you know, my kind of coding education platform that this podcast is kind of centered around, is not B2B or SaaS, but like so many of the learnings are so applicable to what I'm doing that it just ends up being, you know, such a great thing for me to consume content around that, you know,
I could see
really
that.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. No, that's good to hear. And to be honest, like I've always kind of tried to niche my thoughts and content down to what I'm super interested in, because I find that it makes it better. And also I can just go deeper, you know, but I do get that feedback of like, do you realize like 80% of what's in that book that really says SaaS playbook, build a SaaS company, SaaS. It's like probably 70 or 80% could apply to a product service. Could apply to a, you know, what you're doing, which is obviously a coding, you know, do you have a subscription component?
Yeah, it's like a membership.
Yeah. It can apply to that. I definitely was a developer, and then I would build software products and had middling success in the mid to, you know, 2005-ish. But then I also have had multiple information products, courses that I've produced. I owned an e-commerce website. I am trying to think of what else. I've done SaaS. I've done downloadable software. So I've kind of done the gamut of even like content sites that made, you know, money through AdSense. I've done almost every like online business thing you can think of. It just so happens that like SaaS is what became my big interest and focus. And it's a huge space, and I feel like I can add value there. So you're right. A lot of what I bring is actually from other business types as well.
Yeah. I mean, the difference between building a SaaS company and building a WordPress blog and then monetizing through ads, like super, super different. And a lot of times, especially I think for new web developers, it can be kind of confusing, like understanding the difference between like a website that you might use static site generation for or WordPress for, and a web app, right? Like Drip, your kind of email service provider. Very different approaches, both on the business side and on the software development side. So you're probably not too familiar with backend banter yet, but people listening to this podcast are in the process of becoming backend developers. They're learning backend development. And I thought it would be awesome to have you on and talk about the business side of things, the startup side of things, because so many new developers are coming in with the idea to get a first job, right, as a W-2 employee, which I think is great and is a great option for many people. But I want to also make people aware of, you know, what's it like working at a startup or what's it like starting a startup? Because you have these newfound coding skills and, you know, there's not just one path that you can take with coding skills of, you know, becoming a W-2 employee.
That's right. And for me, like, honestly, everything that I've done in my career, I've started 6 companies, 5 of them bootstrapped. I've had a couple exits. I've written 4 books. I have this podcast, as you said, 670, like all this stuff. The single skill that I think, well, there's a couple, there's a skill or a trait of like, I'm pretty perseverant, or I just keep doing stuff forever, as evidenced by the fact, you know, the podcast. But the single skill that I think I learned in my life that has helped me the most is when I learned to code. Because that, even though I don't write code day to day anymore, sometimes I hack a little PHP on the weekends, but I don't tell anyone. But that technical, that the systems thinking, the ability to go into Zapier and just be like, I get it. This is just a graphical API. You know what I mean? Like when it first came out, it was like, people are like, what is this tool? And you just understand it. As developers, we know that, oh, there's a bunch of code under this, but no code and all that. You can go into Airtable, you or I, and build something like that because we know what the paradigms are, right? So even though these days I'm an executive, you know, whatever my title is, having learned to program is what made my career.
So when did you first learn to code? Did you get a CS degree? Were you self-taught?
Self-taught when I was a kid. Yeah, my dad was a construction worker. Mom was a stay-at-home mom. I was youngest of 4 kids. And my dad said, these computers, I'm seeing them around the office. This is the early 80s. I'm seeing them around the office at the shop, right? Where the construction workers show up in the morning and then they go out and do their work. And he said, I think this is a thing. This is going to be a thing. And he got an Apple IIe. He and my mom got that. It was like $4,000, which for an electrician in 1982, let's guess.
Has
to be 10 grand. I mean, it must be the price of like a low-end car. I was shocked that we got it. And my brother and I, who's 4 years older, we came out, we're like, okay, well, I guess we got to do stuff. And I think we either had 0 games or there was 1 game and the game cost $50 and it was just terrible. You know, it was 82 graphics card and an Apple IIe. And so, but it came with a book. I Speak Basic to My Apple. And it was How to Learn Basic. And you know, this is not Visual Basic. This is Basic back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we sat down and we're like, cool, well, let's type in this first program. And it's like, huh, it said hello world back. That's kind of neat. You know, so I can tell it to do things and it'll do things. And pretty soon we were building our own fantasy, all text-based, right? But fantasy games where it would prompt you and be like, you walk into a dungeon, you see a dragon. What do you do? You know, 1, run. 2, fight it. 3, whatever, something else. And it was all, first we hard coded everything with if then else statements. And then it was like, we learned the R&D random. And it was like, oh, it can randomly, you know, you can randomly win or lose if you fight the dragon. Like it blew our minds, the power of this device. So that was when I first learned. And I coded for a handful of years, maybe 5 years, all spaghetti code, self-taught, you know, I mean, there was no, I don't even think I knew what a function was. You know, it wasn't object oriented, so there were no methods, but it was just kind of a mess. And then of course you go to high school, start playing sports, you start paying attention to girls. And I totally stopped coding until college, where I was getting an electrical engineering degree because it's family business. I'm going to go be an electrician or an electrical engineer. And I was like, oh, there's software classes, software development classes, they called them. I was like, I'm going to take a few. And I liked some and hated others because they were trying to teach me structure, right? Which is like, as a self-taught hacker, it was really frustrating to me. But eventually I learned like, oh, this really is cool. So it was like, it was Pascal, C, C++, Java at the time, is the late 90s. And that's when I realized I actually like this stuff way more than the electrical engineering. And I like it way more than certainly than being an electrician.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I actually just recently had an electrical engineer on the podcast who kind of made the transition into coding. Those kinds of things seem to be common. Obviously, you didn't get a degree in programming. How did you transition from this like self-taught hacker coding on the weekends or in school to like your first job in technology?
Yep. And so I was working as an electrician, as a construction worker. I came out of college and I was like, my plan my whole life had been to like go work with my dad at the company. He didn't own it, but it was he worked there for 42 years at this company in the Bay Area. Yeah. And retired there. And like I was gonna, and my brother was gonna, you know, we were all gonna do it. And I didn't really love the construction industry, but it was just the plan. I was set up. Everybody knew me. I was gonna one day run the company maybe, right? So I did it for a little less than 2 years, for about 18 months. And I worked in the field. I did some office work and I was like, this sucks. And so during that time, I started looking for programming jobs. But the problem was there's no one, when was it? It was probably 99, 2000. And so it was
like right around the bust. Yeah.
.com boom. The boom was still going. Okay, and anybody who could fog a mirror could get a job. But they didn't pay you to write Java or C++, or they wanted Perl, ASP, you needed to know HTML. It was all web. And I didn't learn any of that in school, right? Because university, 5 years, 10 years behind, you know, industry. So I would go to the library because I was making a little over minimum wage, but I didn't really have money to buy books. So I went to the library and I checked out books about PHP and Perl and other stuff. And at night I was like, I can learn this. This is like basic, but more complicated. And I mean, I got a few months in of teaching myself at night. And then I started applying for jobs and there was a company in Sacramento that was like, oh, you have a degree. So I did. I had an electrical engineering degree and I had a minor in it was a second degree. It was a double major. So my second major was computer engineering, which is hardware. Okay. Yeah. I literally took like four software classes. You know, I think I named them already. It was like Pascal and a few others. But that CE on my credential plus saying that I kind of had hacked around with Perl and HTML, they were like, great. They were a consultancy for .coms. They were up in Sacramento, but all their clients were in the Bay Area. And so I went up there and started coding dollars for hours, which was amazing. It was like the best trade. It was one of the best decisions of my life, hands down.
Dollars for hours. Yes. The early 2000s, dollars for hours. When the .com bubble eventually did crash, were you still working kind of W-2 employee?
Yep.
Were you laid off? Did you survive?
Yep. So yeah, both. So my wife and I, we got married in May of 2000. And within 1 month, I left a job. I started a new job. We got married and we moved from the Bay Area to Sacramento. Like four huge life changes, very stressful. Get up there and I'm loving this job. And I'm like, oh, I could do this forever, rest of my life. I love coding. I love creating websites. It was just so fun, you know, to be in the thick of it. And so then my wife and I saved up a down payment and we put a down payment on a house December of 2000. And then January of 2001 was one of the first hits of the crash, or maybe it was the second hit, but basically my consulting, the agency that I was working for had maybe 18 people. And he just laid everyone off. And then he picked, I think it was three of us. And he approached me and he said, you're one of the best developers we have here. One of the best people who get stuff done. Will you come work contract for me? And we'll split. So he was charging like $100 an hour, $120 an hour for the work. And he's like, I'll split. You can take 60 minus a 10% payroll. So I think I was like $54 an hour at the time, which, you know, these days sounds preposterous, but it was 23 years ago. And it was, you know, wholesale rates. And also I could work from home. That was the first time I ever worked from home.
Yeah.
So that was a transition. I was super scared. I told him, I don't think I want to do it. I need a salary. I don't think I want to do it. And again, this serendipity that I kind of had to do it, couldn't find work elsewhere, just started doing it. And then it was like, oh no, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. You know, not be a W-2 working an office employee anymore.
So the difference between being W-2, right, full-time employed, and then you were this contractor afterwards, but it sounds like it was a unique kind of contractor. Like, did you have to find your own clients, or was this other guy finding clients for you?
This was he found the clients, and that's why he took the cut. Yep. He basically kept his agency open and just fired all the W-2s and then hired three contractors. I was one of them. And he said, I'm going to keep you as busy as I can. I don't know how busy that will be. And sometimes I would have a few weeks off and I would start getting stressed because I didn't have money in the bank. I mean, we were young. I was like 23, 24, got married young. And I was just stressed. We had this, the house payment wasn't like a huge amount of money, but it certainly as a 23, 24 year old, I'm like, this is the first time I've had a house payment. I don't want to lose the house, as they say. And so I'm doing this contract work and it would come and go. And so, yeah, 1 month I made like $12,000 or $15,000, huge amount of money. And then the next month I had no work. And so I was like, oh, I got to learn to save. And then, oh, taxes come up, right? Estimate, I'm 1099 now. You got it. So like all that stuff I had to learn right around that 2001, 2002 timeframe.
So this is like our first bifurcation for our listeners of like, okay, we all kind of know what working for someone like full-time W-2. It's pretty obvious how that works, right? You show up 40 hours, you're pushing code. What were the biggest differences and like the pros and cons for when you switched to this 1099 work?
Biggest pro of 1099, there were two for me. One, I could work from home. I truly was an independent contractor per the IRS definitions. He didn't dictate the hours I worked. So we were, I was going to say we were single, but my wife and I were newly married with no kids. And so she would like go hang out with friends and I would code from like 8 p.m. at night until 2 in the morning because that's my body clock. I'd never been able to do that. I was super productive. So I'd work like 6 hours then, and then I'd get up the next day, I'd work 2 more hours, that's a day, and then I'd like screw off the rest of the day. So having time freedom was huge. Location freedom. I worked from my house. I loved it. I had our dog, didn't have to go into a cube, got my stuff done. And then the third was I actually made a lot more money. I believe I was making 65K W-2. So before that, right? So it's about $32 an hour. And suddenly I was making this $54 an hour. And in fact, that got bumped up to 60 within a year. So suddenly I was making almost, if I worked full-time, I was making about twice as much. And I found that I could stay busy almost full-time. So instantly my income, like the next, so I made like 65K for what it's worth for the latter half of 2000. And then I think in 2001, I probably made like 95K. Like, so didn't quite double, but I had more freedom and I made more money. And then the next year I made like 110, you know, I kept tracking it to make sure that I was on track to expand it. So the income independence and the time independence and the location independence were three big pros. And then of course the cons were I didn't have work full time and I did sweat that, you know. The other thing was I wasn't in control. I wasn't bringing in clients. And that's something I started doing. So I started blogging about 4 or 5 years later about ASP.NET, which is what I was coding in at the time. And just software development stuff. And I did start getting my own clients who I could then bill at that 100 to 150 an hour my straight. And then I didn't need to be busy full time because I could make the money. I made more money per hour, but that was a drag in the early 2000s for me. Was I was just this kid with no connections. And if the work dried up or if he decided to shut down, I would have just had to go and try to find another job, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you did pretty well through the 2001 crash, which is great to hear, at least personally. Obviously, yeah. It sucks to see all your coworkers get laid off.
Totally. Well, and I tell people that. I even tell my kids a lot, like, you know, crashes will come, bad things will happen. But if you, like, I worked really hard and was really good, even though I was early, I was pretty good at what I was doing, you know, with the Pearl that I was 8 months into. Apparently, I stood out from the 18 employees, that I was one that I was at least in the top three. So why is that? Well, I think I worked pretty hard for him. I was never a headache to him. You know, I was never like, oh, our stuff, I was not buggy. I tested my code. Like everything I shipped kind of just worked. And he loved that as the owner because he had other people who just, he'd show it to a client and it would crash, right? And it's like, oh, we'll take care of that. You know, and you feel like crap. And that never happened to mine. So it was, I guess what I'm saying is like, when I teach my kids who are teenagers, like be one of the best and it's unlikely you'll ever be out of work.
You did this 1099 thing, what was it, 5 years or so?
On and off and on. So I did, yeah, I did the 1099. My wife and I moved to LA for her grad school, found a new guy who was doing something similar. So I was, you know, he was kind of finding the work again. And then I remember being a little burned out on 1099. Grass is always greener, by the way. I went from 1099 to W-2. Then back to 1099, then back to W-2 again. And each time I was like, this sucks. I'm going to go to the other, you know, and then eventually I 1099'd as I built my products up. And the last time I ever worked for anyone, client or, you know, employer, it was a client, was like late 2008. I think it was late 2008 during the big, other big crash. So I did have some W-2 jobs and I became a manager during that time. And I hired, that's where I learned to hire, which is a great, it's a great skill. Working on teams with other people, I find that folks who want to start their own startup who have never worked for a company are at a disadvantage because they don't know what it's like to work inside a company and have some framework of like, this is how it maybe should be structured.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Like, you don't have that model in your head already to base anything off of, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So one question I get a lot from, you know, self-taught developers learning to code for the first time is, should I get my first job as a W-2 or should I just start freelancing? And sometimes the thought process there is, if I freelance, I don't have to pass interviews. And so, like, again, it comes back to that idea of like shortcutting, which I personally am not a huge fan of, but I want to hear your thoughts on, like, does it ever make sense to freelance first or should you always go W-2 first? How do you weigh those?
If I were faced with that decision today, knowing what I know now, I would want to W-2. And more specifically, if I'm essentially a junior dev, is what you're saying. I want to learn from others. The way you get good really fast is by being around other people who are way better than you at anything. And in this case, joining a team of a SaaS startup or a tech startup or somebody who's writing, you know, a team of 10, 20, 30 people who are writing code, where you're going to get code reviewed and your code is going to improve at a rapid pace versus freelancing, you're on your own. I just think the strides that I made once I hit once I started working 40 hours a week coding, that was the first big kicker, was like, oh, I'm in here 40 hours a week, I'm going to get better way faster. That's the first thing. And then the second one was having other people look at my code, which frankly didn't happen at the first several jobs. It's funny. There was no code reviewing back then. There was no unit testing back then. Like that's how long ago this was. You know, unit testing came about, I think, around 2006 or seven. And code reviews was maybe after that. We did code reviews at a credit card company because we had PCI compliance. So we started doing that around 05, 06.
So everyone was just shipping, just crazy, slinging, right? Code and shipping.
Well, you'd sling code and we would test. You would test your stuff. And then there was a QA department, which again, these days, I mean, we built Drip, my last SaaS app, to millions of dollars in revenue, zero QA testers, because we had crazy unit test coverage, high code quality. The devs tested their code, then I tested their code, and then we'd test it once more with our customer service people if we thought it was, you know, a complex change. If it was simple, we kind of gauged it. Yeah, we don't need to triple test. But back then it was more waterfall stuff where you just spec it out and then you build it all. And I'm so glad we're done with those days.
So your first 5 or so years, I'm guessing it was all waterfall development. And could you maybe explain what that is just really quickly?
Yeah. I mean, imagine a series of like a river flowing, and then there's like a waterfall and another and another and another. So it's like a sequence of 5 waterfalls. And the reason folks use that was you basically spent a month specking something out. You wrote a technical spec of how every database column and how all the code was going to do this, and then what it was going to do in the back end layer. And then you wrote a functional spec, which was kind of on the front end, how it was going to work for the user. And so you'd create these two documents, and sometimes they were 5 pages and sometimes they were 50 pages each, depending on how big the thing was. So you spent a week or sometimes months on these big consulting engagements, just writing docs, no code, which just drive me nuts because I'm here to code, y'all. I'm here to build stuff, not create documentation. So then that's the first waterfall. And then once you fall down from there, you really can't go back. You can't go back up a waterfall. And so that's the thing, is like, you could modify the spec if you got in. You're like, oh, we made a mistake and it should be a Boolean instead of an int. But realistically, client sign-off, it was like, cool, so that's our scope. Now we create an estimate. It's going to cost $100,000 to build this based on that spec. That's locked in. Anything you change from here on is a change order, right? Or it will likely result in more money. So then you would, I don't even remember what it was next. It was like, we'd architect the database, and that was the next waterfall. And it's like, don't touch the database after that, you know? And then it was right at the back end or whatever. There was a sequence of things that happened that really were foundational. It was not iterative. It's the opposite of iterative, which is how I think pretty much most software should be developed today. There's exceptions. If you're building medical devices that could kill people, NASA, you know, air traffic control, there needs to be there's zero tolerance for any type of error. Most of the stuff, you, me, anyone listening to this podcast building, it should be iterative. Please don't do waterfall. It's just not the ideal way to do it anymore.
Yeah. So websites were being built like houses are now. Like, this sounds like the process I went through when, like, we built our house.
Exactly.
We go pick all the fixtures, they give us an estimate, it's going to be all this money. You know, they decided that they couldn't put in the furnace that we wanted, so they found another furnace. We had to do this whole change order process and negotiate on price. It was awful.
Yep. That was
so awful. It sounds like, yeah, it's awful. So it sounds like you didn't do Drip that way. Now, was Drip your first fully fledged software company that you did after this like period of W-2 and contractor work, or was there some other stuff?
There was a bunch of stuff in between. Yeah. Drip was December 2012. And so I was making a full-time living from my own products, much in the start small, stay small approach by 2008. So there was 4 years in between there of 4.5 years of me learning more about marketing. And like, I was a developer who learned how to market, which is like, man, you're a force to be reckoned with at that point. It's crazy how powerful you can be. And so that is when I had one e-commerce site that sold, it did drop shipping for beach towels, made $2,000 a month. I had a couple of eBooks. I had, you know, all these downloadable software. I had a SaaS in the wedding industry that wasn't great, because the wedding industry is kind of rough. I eventually parlayed, and I had bought those by freelancing on the side. So I would take W-2 job, I'd freelance nights and weekends, save up 5 or 10 grand, and then I'd acquire one or more of those. So I built up this portfolio to where I was like, shit, I'm making 150 grand a year. I'm living in California. I can afford a house. And like, it was all just this product income. We had a second kid around then. I took about 10 months where I worked, you know, 4-hour work week type thing. I worked about 12 hours a week in 2010. And then I acquired a SaaS app called Hittail. And then I parlayed that up to start Drip, because Drip cost me about almost 200 grand out of pocket to start it. So it was kind of like I angel invested, but that was all profit from Hittail, which I had bought Hittail with profit from these other companies that I had bought from freelance. You know what I mean? It's like, I call it the stair-step approach of like, I didn't have friends and family. I didn't know anyone who would give me money to start a startup, but I just kind of built my own path, you know, over the course of these years, and just parlayed one to the next, which is why it took me, you know, a decade from when I started to kind of sell Drip, in essence.
Yeah. So, having consumed a significant amount of startups with the rest of us over the last month, I've now heard about the stair step method a couple times, and I want to like try to echo it back to you to make sure I kind of understand. So you kind of started out as a W-2 employee. I don't necessarily think that factors into the stair step approach, but like the first step in the stair step approach is like, do something where you're no longer selling your time for money is the idea, right? So rather than like being paid $100 an hour to write code, you're launching an ebook that brings you in cash every time it sells or something like that. And I think the idea is that like the earlier steps don't take a lot of time to get going, right? Or you don't have to code this giant app and come up with this huge marketing campaign, right? You can like, I don't know, start a community or do an information product, something you can get out quicker. Am I on the right track?
Yes. Yeah. And specifically that step one that you're talking about. Yeah. The idea is that it doesn't take a ton of time to build. And usually I've found that it often has a single traffic channel, meaning it kind of does well in SEO and that's it. And it plateaus, or you build a Shopify app, or you put out a Coursera course, whatever course platforms there are these days, yeah, where you actually publish it on their stuff. Or maybe even, isn't there like Theme Forest, like those types of things, mm-hmm, where they're doing the marketing, they take a cut, but really you don't have to learn marketing. You're just kind of cutting your teeth at like, well, hey, look, I made $100 last month. That's pretty cool. That's what I think of as a step one business, where you don't have to learn, because it's complicated, right? Launching a full-blown SaaS is a lot of work and it's a lot of complexity to maintain. So
yeah, get those first dollars that come in while you're sleeping, even if it's right, just a few, right?
Yep.
Would you take, and then obviously like you kind of stair-step your way up, and kind of the end rung is something like a fully fledged SaaS application. For everyone listening, that's SaaS. And could you just explain really quickly, what is a SaaS?
Yeah, so it stands for Software as a Service. And realistically, it's the worst name ever, because it's like, what the hell is that? All it means is it's any software you use in a browser that you pay a subscription for. So even like Dropbox or Google Cloud, right? Or Google, not Google Cloud, but Google, like Google Workspace, right? Where I have that I pay for my team, or Basecamp or MailChimp, or, you know, any of these. Those are kind of the most common SaaS companies. And the beauty of those, I mean, they're complicated, they're competitive. There's a bunch of things that make them hard to do when you're a beginner, but the beauty of them is recurring revenue. and it just grows and grows and grows if you put money into it. And not having recurring revenue, everyone who thinks, oh, I don't need recurring revenue, and then they do it and they get this one-time revenue, eventually they want recurring.
I'm kind of going through that at the moment. So technically, Boot Dev is a subscription service, right? And there's a huge asterisk on technically. Because at the end of the day, we are putting together what is a career path. So you can think of it like a college degree. And, you know, most people, if they're successful along the career path, kind of graduate and are done, right? And at that point, either cancel their membership or whatever. So we're actually going through right now trying to figure out maybe there's like something we can do on the end where like the subscription fees are super low and you're getting like podcast episodes or something. But it is much more challenging, I think, from a business model perspective to run a business that is not just this like, if it's a great tool, people will pay you month after month.
Yeah, if people graduate from it, it becomes a challenge. That's actually why earlier I made a quick comment about, I had a SaaS in the wedding industry, and it's terrible because people get married once, and it's very finite, and they always cancel when it ends. So it's like the opposite. It should really be a one-time fee, which eventually I moved it to. And I know some people do as well. There are certain tools and certain businesses that just shouldn't, they really shouldn't be subscription. You know, it's very hard to make them subscription. And the signal you see is the churn is super high, right? The cancellation rate is super high. And it's like, huh, that either I don't have product market fit, I haven't built something people want and are willing to pay for, or it just shouldn't be a subscription and it should be a one-timer and you know, maybe an annual fee.
Yeah. To kind of pull back the curtain, at least on my business, we basically have like, whether you are unsuccessful as a student, so like you get in, do a couple courses and leave, or you're successful to get in, do all the courses and leave, like eventually at some point on the current iteration of the platform, you're churning basically, which is like really hard. Cause like with a typical SaaS business, you look at churn as just this purely negative thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas we have this interesting thing where it's like, well, if you churn after a year and get a job, like we're actually super excited about that. Mm-hmm. So it's a totally different way of looking at the world. With this stair step method in mind that you brought up and how you started, I love your journey because it like covers every different thing that a coder slash entrepreneur could do over, you know, 20 years. Would you do it the same way again? Like if you have a kid that wants to become a developer, maybe eventually become an entrepreneur, would you recommend them take a similar path?
Probably. I mean, there are some people who say, I don't want to learn to code. I just want to be an entrepreneur. And then I'd say, then don't learn to code. Find a developer co-founder, technical co-founder, or learn no code, or do a productized service first and parlay that. I've seen some folks do that. So there are other options. But if it's like, no, I'm technical and I want to learn to code with the ultimate goal of being an entrepreneur, I'd say, A, good for you. You're going to be in hot demand because everybody needs a really good technical co-founder. And B, I think there's so much value, like I said earlier, in being a W-2 employee because you learn what it's like to work on a team, to do code review, to best practices being on a team, even to hire. Like I learned how to interview and how to hire developers at my W-2 jobs, right? And then for me, the 1099 was, I don't think you need to do that step. That was purely because I was like, I want to make more money. I want more freedom. If you want to do that, that's fine. But I think you could seriously just nights and weekends at your W-2. And that's where the step one of a stair step is like doable nights and weekends versus building drip nights and weekends. It was like, I don't know how many hours to get us to V1, but it would have taken probably 1,000 hours of code, you know, or whatever, like a huge number. So it's like, all right, nights and weekends, that's 100 weeks, right? I'm going to go for 2 years and not, it's just, that's where step one is a simpler entry level. And you called out that I did it, which is exactly right. I'm not the only one though. I wrote a blog post about this that mentions like 6 or 8 other people I've seen do the stair step method. And since then, it's just constant. I just see it on Twitter of like, I'm doing the stair step and this is where I am. So it's like, it's not just a theory. I don't want people to think that I took my experience and came up with this whole framework that hypothetically should exist. It's like, no, people are doing this all the time.
That makes complete sense. And I love what you said about, you don't need to learn to code to be an entrepreneur. Like that's absolutely true, but it is really hard to start a business without at least one of the founders being technical. I mean, I hear you say this on your podcast. I hear Y Combinator say it on their podcast. And those are two different types of companies, right? You mostly talk about kind of bootstrapping, starting your own startup, whereas Y Combinator is all about like venture track, you know, raising large amounts of money. But both companies I'm hearing say, you need someone technical on the team. Why is that? Why can't I just hire a firm. Yeah.
Hire an agency, hire a freelancer. Because agencies are really expensive and freelancers might not be expensive, but they, as a rule, don't care enough. And if you are non-technical, and we see this, we have some, so I run an accelerator you mentioned, for it's a SaaS accelerator for bootstrappers, really, called Tiny Seed. And we've invested, between that and my own investments, 151 companies I'm in, almost all SaaS. I think there's maybe two that aren't SaaS. So I see a lot, right? I just have insight into a lot of companies. And in general, the handful that have no technical founders just struggle. They struggle. No matter who they hire, they you don't know how to vet that person. How do I even know if you're any good? And then it's like, cool. We all know with code, it's like, hey, let's see if the thing works. All right, so start building my tool. And they build it and they launch a web page. You're like, hey, this works. This person must be amazing. 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, bugs all over the place, no unit tests, regression error. You don't see it until you're right on the line. And then you're like, well, this person's no good. I'm going to bring in someone else to fix all this. So you let them go. You bring in a new dev who's like totally lost. Oh my God, the code quality is terrible. I need to rewrite everything. So how many non-technical teams have I seen rewrite their entire code base multiple times because they bring in that new dev? And then, yeah, it's terrible. So it's not all the time. I'm not going to say 100%, but in terms of like the ecosystem that I exist in, the SaaS, specifically software as a service, it's like maybe 10, 15% of those companies that I see doing reasonably well don't have a technical co-founder. So I guess the other way to say it is 85%+ have at least one technical person. Even if sometimes, so like when I started Drip, I didn't write a single line of code on Drip. So, and I would say I was the founder for like a year and a half. And then the contractor who I had hired to write all the code became a co-founder retroactively. So, but I was a guy who could write code. So I knew how to vet him. I was like, hey, let's write unit test. You know what I mean? I like knew the right, I knew how to build software, even though I didn't write the code on that.
You saw his pull requests, right? You saw the code that he was pushing to production. You could debug it if you needed to.
If I needed to. Yeah.
This is like kind of how my experience has been. I don't have a ton of strong opinions on like AI generated code yet. You know, it's only been a few months. Honestly, it's crazy how fast everything's moving.
Yep.
But my experience has been very similar in the sense that like, I still can't like just go tell my friend who doesn't know how to code to build me a website because I've given them a ChatGPT account. Because I have technical skills, I can use ChatGPT to generate some code or get me unstuck. Those fundamental skills are almost what is enabling me to be effective using the tool. At least that's been my experience so far.
That would be it. I think even if I was in front of ChatGPT today, I would, if I was building something small, I could do it. And if I did it in PHP or a language that I know, if I tried to do a big project in ChatGPT, I would fumble it because I haven't written production code in 10 years.
Yeah. You wrote a lot of code and then you, was it kind of just like a cold turkey? You kind of just were done at one point because you're on the business side?
That was it. And it was a tough transition. I hung on to coding for a very long time because I love it. I really enjoy it. But at a certain point, I was like, look, I want to build something big and I want to exit for a lot of money and or just grow it and be profitable. I didn't know that I wanted to sell from day one, but I knew that me coding would be a detriment. And so when I found this guy that I really liked and he was sharp, he was like 21 at the time. He's a young dude, but he wrote really high quality code. I didn't know Ruby on Rails and he was really good at it. And that was actually a deliberate decision. Was I said, do you want to write it in Rails? He said, absolutely. And I said, good, because then I can't get in and code. I could, to your point, I could debug stuff because it's Ruby. You kind of know it well enough, right? If you know 10 languages, you know the 11th. But I was not, it was a nice, you know, guardrail for me to not just dive into the code and try to fix stuff.
I mean, that's our tendency, right? As programmers, is to just want to sit down and code. That's definitely what I have struggled with the most, you know, building a business. It's like, I could go work on like marketing and positioning and copywriting and content, or I could sit down and like fix a few bugs. Like that sounds like fun.
Certainly in my comfort zone to change code, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked just a second ago about how amongst like all of the co-founders in the world, if you're technical, it's kind of like a superpower, right? Because you don't need to outsource. You don't need to go find a technical co-founder. I know that you run MicroConf, right? A conference for kind of indie creators or mostly bootstrappers. I'm curious if in the community of kind of co-founders that are maybe like, quote unquote, co-founder dating, right? Like looking for people to start companies with, is there sort of a supply demand issue between technical and non-technical co-founders, or are there too many technical, too many non-technical? What's that situation like?
Well, you can never have too many technical. So I would not say too many, but there is an imbalance in our community. And the reason I believe is because the community sprang out of the podcast, Startups for the Rest of Us. The podcast started as two software developers who were doing entrepreneurial stuff. So some days we talk about tech stuff and some days we talk about business stuff. And so it drew an inordinate amount of developer founders, developer geeks who wanted to someday launch a business. So that has carried over to MicroConf. So I would say similarly to my 85%+ number earlier, I bet that MicroConf itself as a community, which is tens of thousands of people, if not more than 100,000, depending on how you count, is probably got to be 60 to 70% developers. Somewhere in that range.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Maybe 75. It used to be way higher. I mean, I bet our first event was probably 90% developers. This is 2011. And then it has slowly gone down, which is good, right? To get a little more balance. And then it's funny when I go to like marketing events and everyone's like, where are all the entrepreneurial developers? And I'm like, oh, you should come to my event. It's all entrepreneurial developers. And they're looking for marketers and folks who know sales and, you know, the business side of things.
That's really interesting. Yeah, because like I was listening to, I can't remember, some piece of content the Y Combinator put out, and they had said that, yeah, they have this huge problem where they get tons of people applying. I guess they do some sort of co-founder matching stuff, and they just do not have enough technical people. Maybe that's more because of the venture track mindset, but it sounds like...
Yeah. A lot of people come out with an MBA or they're studying to MBA and it's like, well, this is what you do. You go raise money from people and build it something, you know? And it's like, yeah, if you don't have technical skills, you do. If you have technical skills, you build it nights and weekends, you know, and
you just you get build it.
You just build it. And then you get it to the point where it's making a few grand. And then it becomes way easier to, if you do want to raise funding, which is a perfectly viable path. If you do want to raise funding, it's so much easier once you have something to market and you've shown that you are, you know, are capable of shipping.
Well, I mean, the number one expense, correct me if I'm wrong, with the SaaS companies that I've worked at in the past is always salary, right? So it's like, if you can just do it, then you don't necessarily need to raise as much money. That's right.
Yeah, that's right. And the folks who do raise, so Tiny Seed, we write checks between, let's say, 120,000 up to maybe 250, sometimes 300, depending on. We had someone apply to Tiny Seed with $100,000 in monthly recurring revenue, so like doing 1.2 million. So you obviously have to extend the definition of an accelerator at that point. But most of our folks are between, you know, 1,000 MRR and 30,000-ish MRR. And if they're above that, they wind up, we have a syndicate where they can kind of raise a pre-seed round through us, also from the bootstrapper friendly. But that gives you a range, and it's not a huge amount. That sounds like a lot of money when I say 120 to 250. Sounds like a lot of money. It isn't when you're talking about salaries, you know? And so usually a technical, if there's a technical and a marketing co-founder, for example, two co-founders, the nice part is then they don't have to hire a marketer at the start, and they don't have to hire a developer at the start. Now, they may, depending on their space, if it's super competitive product-wise, meaning you're building an ESP, there's like 500, literally 500 ESPs. Your product needs a year or two of development just for table stakes. First hire, it's probably going to be support. Second one's going to be another developer just to move the product faster. But if you're in a niche, let's say you're building something for hair salon software, right? Or, you know, some really specific thing. Usually the product doesn't have to be that sophisticated. So then you're going to have that salary go that much further. You're going to either just use it as marketing budget, or maybe you do hire someone to accelerate sales or something like that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So to shift gears just a little bit, or I guess to like re-ask the question in a slightly different way, we've talked about how with development skills, you can get into business, right? And you kind of talked about how it can be challenging to do that upfront. It's really great if you can learn on somebody else's dime, right? By getting a job and learning from your peers. How do you think about the difference between working at a bootstrapped or mostly bootstrapped company versus going and like getting a job at a huge tech giant?
Yeah, pros and cons, right? Pros of a big tech giant, you're going to probably make a higher salary. You, depending on in their growth curve, you're going to get some stock options that may or may not be worth something. You're going to see how a big org operates. And you'll probably have, if you're on a team, let's say you're on the DevOps team or something, you're going to have some really sharp people to learn from, right? Really sharp or potentially world-class, depending on which tech giant you work for. The cons of the tech giants are you're going to impact nothing. You are one of 1,000 developers, let's say, and you are just shipping code to, you're not shipping features of the app. You're doing some back end to the back end of the back end that, you know what I mean? The contribution just isn't there. Your learning will stagnate relatively quickly, I think, unless you really jump up the layers. And politics. Every big org, no matter, it's just, you've worked at them, I've worked at them. The moment you get to 100, 200 people, it's like, oh, this is where the team's too big. So the flip side is working at a startup is like, you're going to learn a ton. You're going to have probably less mentorship, but man, you're going to impact and learn how this runs, you know? And small teams, if they run well, are super fun. They're just, it's way more fun to work on both of my companies, TinySeed and MicroConf, are each, depending on how you count, about 5-person teams, 5 or 6 each. And it's great. And both of them could be about, I bet we could get up to about 15 each and still be amazing. And then when you, at a certain point, it's like, oh, it's just a little bigger now. We're no longer a 2-pizza team, if you've heard that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Those to me are the best types of teams to work for, but you're right. But you won't make as much money. You may or may not get stock options, you know, and you may not have world-class mentorship, but I do still think you learn from the experience of working on it.
Yeah, just like my own personal take on this, and I definitely don't want anyone to feel like I'm prescribing this, but I worked at companies with like less than 10 people total. And I think the challenge, if you're like super new, is that you're figuring everything out on your own. It's almost the freelancer problem, just to less of an extent. In the sense that someone tells you to ship it. Yeah. And you just like go ship it and you don't know if like you did it well or you didn't do it well. Whereas like the startups I've worked at that are between like 25 and 100 people, it's almost like you can get that amazing mentorship, because very often it's like sometimes you're even working with like the CTO or the technical co-founder who probably has this amazing skill set. But you can still have huge impact and like ship a whole feature.
So that may be the sweet spot then. You know, is that 25 to 100 or 25 to 150? I wouldn't disagree with that.
It certainly was for me, and it makes sense from first principles when I sort of reason it backwards. And I have definitely seen a lot of people fall into the trap of kind of, I don't know, sometimes when there's like a really small company that's just getting started, I feel like the entrepreneurs themselves maybe don't know what they're doing. And so they just like hire a cheap junior developer and expect the world from them.
Yeah.
And that can like be a huge hit to your confidence if you're shipping a product and then they tell you it's crap and you're like, but I don't know how, like I'm new.
Yeah, I would agree.
I have one last like fairly technical question that I want to talk about. In regard to, I mean, this is back-end banter, and mostly we've kept it kind of vague and just web development banter up to this point. But I want to talk about just a little bit the difference between like back-end development skills, front-end development skills, and full-stack skills in like the bootstrap landscape. And let me give you an example. So V1 Google was a very back-end heavy product in the sense that like the UI was a search bar, right? And the thing that made Google interesting was like all this behind the scenes work that's going on. Not every product is like that. Some products do require a lot of visual and front end work. In the bootstrapped space, is there like a 50-50 dichotomy? Do you just need to be full stack? Do you just need to ship the whole thing? Or by the time the company gets to 20 people, do you need a lot of data oriented people doing systems work? How do you think about those skills and how they line up with bootstrapping?
If I were to kind of, you know, put my finger in the air and think about across the companies I advise, I would say it's a pretty even mix of back end to front end work. And so being a full stack is definitely beneficial. Usually the founder has to be full stack because you just kind of have to get it out. Whether they're good at both is another question. And then usually the first few hires on the dev team, since you're so cash strapped, wind up being mostly full stack. And I think that's the way it winds up. And then there's kind of a fork where some SaaS apps are just pretty simple CRUD, create, read, update, delete. You know, I think of like Basecamp as an example. Like I would love to run that app. It just feels pretty, it's pretty simple, so to speak, on the back end. I don't think it's like this massive scaling problem. And so Do you need people doing systems work when it was 10 employees? Probably not, you know? So there are some like that. And of course, there are tiny seed companies like that, that just, they got into space and it's not that hard to scale it or to keep building. Yeah. Then you think of a company like Drip, where, all right, so we're going to send 100 million emails a month when we're doing a couple million a year in revenue, and we're going to 10X this over the next few years. Like, it become, you know, your sidekick is just running like crazy. And pretty soon the database is on the biggest EC2 instance Amazon has. It's a 32 terabytes of, whenever they would release the bigger one of RAM. So it was like 8 terabytes of RAM. And we're like, dude, that is so expensive. And then it would like, database having a problem, 16 terabytes of RAM. And when it came out, we moved the database. So that is a scaling issue. And at that point, yes, we had like an entire platform team by the time we got acquired, and they had venture funding. And so they had several engineers who were just trying to keep things scaling and rewriting systems into different data stores to keep it all going. So there's a fork in the road there. And I would say it's certainly the minority that needs to do all the scaling, but it exists, right? I mean, if you built Zapier, if you built Segment, there's a bunch of apps that we use on a day-to-day basis that you would need those hardcore backend skills.
Yeah. I love hearing this, especially from someone who runs obviously MicroConf and TinySeed and sees a lot of the landscape, because a lot of times if you're just kind of browsing Twitter, you'll see someone tweet like, oh, you don't need to know how to do X to be a developer. And it's just because they worked at a company that didn't do X. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Like you said, Drip, Basecamp, N of one, totally different.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an N of one. It's someone who has worked at one place and doing it right. And I try to, if at all possible, look across 150 companies and to make my assessment.
Yeah. Makes sense. Last question before we get to your books and all the cool stuff that I want people to go check out is, if you just had like one or two pieces of advice for someone who's learning to code in 2023 with like all the uncertainties around like macroeconomic environment, all that kind of stuff, like what are just like the one or two things that you would tell to someone that's trying to get into this industry?
First, I would say, I don't think your coding skills, whatever you learn, they will never hurt you. And I think they will only be to your benefit long-term, even if you never get a full-time job as a developer, because learning to code makes you better at no code. It makes you better at wrangling spreadsheets when you need to go into a macro. It's like, oh, this is just coding and just a different, it's just a really simplified dorky coding, but like, I'll make it work. You know, it's like there's so much I do in my day-to-day life still that I'm like, just because I learned how to code, I know how, somehow I can find settings on my iPhone easier than my mom because I know how to code, you know? So that's like my first thing is I'm a huge proponent of it for those who want to. I don't think everyone should. Some people just don't want to. It doesn't fit their brain. The other thing I would say is, if I were trying to get into it, I would, and maybe you already do this on this show, but I would look at, what do I think, let's say the top three web languages or web coding platforms are, right? So in my mind, this may or may not still be, I think it's Rails. I think it's Ruby on Rails. I think it's Python Django. And I think maybe Node is a third, but one of those first two I named, that's what I'd be. And I know there's now Elixir and there's other stuff. So I don't want to act like, you know, but like over the long term, I would just pick one of those. And oh, I guess PHP Laravel is what I meant as the third. Node would be fourth. I would pick one of those and learn it, and you'll find a job if you're good. Like, it's not that hard to get a
job.
If
you're good is important, right?
Yes, that's the thing. And then how do you get good, right? Hard work.
Yeah.
Hard work to build the skill. So I don't have anything. I don't have anything other than that, other than like, if you want to learn to code, you can totally do it. And yeah, it'll be a skill that'll follow you around forever. And there is a ton of work out there for developers. I guess that is the other thing I would say is, if you don't know how to code today, or you're thinking, oh my God, ChatGPT is going to take my job. Developer, I mean, back in 2002, we're not going to have any jobs because they're all going to be offshored. That was a huge thing. There were books written about it. People were mad. U.S. citizens were mad as hell. U.S. coders, I should say. Because it was like, I bill $100 an hour and they're going to take my job to the Philippines and make $4 an hour. And it's like, yeah, that did happen. And guess what? Rates have still gone up. There's still not enough developers even in the whole world. Like, I'm a believer that there will be developers in one form or another for the foreseeable, but for decades, maybe 100 years from now, AI writes it or something. But I'm not convinced. No code is not going to end development. AI is not going to end development in any type of close time frame, you know, in our careers.
Fantastic advice. I love to hear it. And just so you know, and anyone who's listening that isn't familiar with what we do teach on Boot Dev, Python and Go and JavaScript are kind of our bread and butter. But the reality of
necessity. Yeah.
Yeah. The reality of back-end development is that like kind of any language can run on the back end in essence. I mean, you've got frameworks that are great. You've got tools that are great. But the nice thing about servers is you're not constrained by the browser.
Right.
So I'm with you. Pick something, learn it really well, and you'll be in demand. Where can people find your stuff and what are you working on currently?
So if folks are listening to this podcast, I imagine they might want to listen to another podcast. That's Startups for the Rest of Us. You can find it in any podcast app or startupsfortherestofus.com. If you're watching this on YouTube, you can head to just go in the search bar and search for MicroConf. And that's really my channel where I put out a YouTube 52 YouTube videos a year on topics around SaaS. And then the last thing, we talked about the SaaS playbook, and you can go to saasplaybook.com to buy that book or go to amazon.com if you want to buy it there. Although I make more royalties if you come straight to SaaS playbook, but I understand Amazon is nice one click.
Hey, fantastic. Yeah, I'll be buying I can get the hardcover on your site.
DM me. It's paperback, print on demand, but I have hardcovers. Unfortunately, listeners, you'll have to do paperback unless you really want a hardcover, but you can DM me. We'll figure it out.
Cool. Awesome. Thanks so much, Rob. We'll talk to you later.
My pleasure.